Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 231. It's Wednesday, September 3rd. I'm going to turn the mic down just a little bit. Okay. Hopefully you all can hear me in the back. And I've got the recorder on, so this is good. 231, September 3rd. We're going to finish up cells and move into tissues today. But let's take a formal look at the schedule to make sure that we're all on the same schedule. So Labor Day was Monday, today Wednesday. Yep, we're going to get into tissues. We're going to finish up cells. Still have a lot of material, but we have two lectures for tissues, so that's fine. Then integument, and then we're going to look at some bone tissue in particular, and then the first exam. So the first exam is going to be, all right, today's the third, so 2 weeks away. First exam, 2 weeks away. So it is coming upon us. So don't forget, these are the chapters, these are the page numbers, these are the same page numbers that you see in Blackboard. The study guides are in Blackboard. Print out those figures, start working with those figures, and I'll even start working those figures in lab as well. All right, and anybody have any questions on where we are in the class, the schedule, that kind of thing? All right, here is the sign-in sheet that I'm going to pass around, and you should sign not Monday, but Wednesday. Usually I'd mark it off really nice. But anyway, sign by your name anywhere here. If you're not on this list, then you got to see me today, and we'll figure out why you're not on this list, because this is the latest and greatest official registration. All right, don't freak out, but we'll figure out what's wrong. All right, so sign in by your name, pass it around. And if I drop you for not being in class, and you can point to where you signed every time, then obviously you were in class, so I would have to reinstate you. So that's your receipt that you're in class. Okay. Any questions on anything that we covered last time, which was cells? And what is a structural and functional unit of life? A cell, that's right. Life is made up of cells. If something is not made up of cells, then it can't be alive. Plus, you should know what the definition of a cell is in this class. I said you got to have three things. What are the three things that something, this particle, has to have in order for it to be a cell? Okay, it's got to have genetic material. I heard that. Some people said nucleus. Not a nucleus per se, but at least genetic material, which is inside the nucleus for us. But not every kind of cell has a nucleus, even though it has genetic material, right? Like a bacteria has no nucleus, but it has a chromosome. All right, so genetic material. Cell membrane, and cytoplasm, yeah, cytosol or organelles inside the cell. Now, some organisms don't have organelles, but they still have cytoplasm in the form of cytosol. Okay, so those are living organisms. All right, so last time we looked at all of these things. Let me get some pictures up here just in case I want to look at some pictures. Nice. So you should know some bullet points of these various organelles, right? Like Golgi apparatus. What is, in one or two words, what does a Golgi apparatus do? Modification. I like that. It can take a protein, modify, maybe add a sugar molecule to it, for instance, and packaging. Then it takes that modified product, puts it in a vesicle, and then the vesicle takes it wherever it should go. Maybe someplace else in the cell or outside the cell. That would be part of the secretory pathway. What about a lysosome? Digestion, yeah, intracellular digestive system. So if these lysosomes start to break down inside your cells, they will digest your cells from the inside out. That would be a terrible thing. Okay, we talked about chromosomes made up of DNA. And a chromosome that you can see underneath the microscope, is that condensed chromatin or extended chromatin? It is a condensed form that you can see with the light microscope. And is that condensed chromatin safe or easily damaged? It's in a safe form, right, because it's all wound up on those histone molecules. And let's see, can it be used? Is condensed chromosome useful? Can a cell use condensed chromatin to make new proteins? And the answer is no. It's safe but unusable. What's the usable form? extended chromatin. And what's one feature about extended chromatin? And it's the reason why extended chromatin is only found in the nucleus, behind the nuclear membrane. It's easily damaged because it's a long, extremely thin molecule. It can break, and then all that information is lost. All right, so that's a little bit of a review from last time. I don't think I talked about transport mechanisms just yet. So let's start with that, and maybe I can find a slide of that. Maybe not. I'm not sure. Okay, but molecules move around from one place to another. And here is that cell. And the cell membrane allows materials that the cell needs to get through the cell membrane, and it also then releases things that it doesn't need outside the cell. And it's a job of this plasma membrane to direct that traffic and make it possible. Right. Sometimes a molecule will move all by itself, will not require energy. So for instance, if I had a perfume bottle right here and I open the cap of that perfume bottle, even though there's not a fan in this room, there's no air currents, do you feel a breeze on your face or anything? No, there's no currents of air. But if I open that perfume bottle, right, will you be able to smell it? First the people in the front row, then those molecules will move back, people in the second row will smell it, then third, and then finally all the way back of the room, right, if we wait long enough. All right, so that's an example of a passive transport process. Does not require energy. Molecules will move all by themselves, right, but things can only move from high concentration to low. So why did we say that the molecule moved from me, which is in the front of the room, all the way to the back? Because in the front of the room, what's the concentration right around that perfume bottle? It's high concentration. And what about the concentration in the back of the room? It's low. So this molecule will move from high concentration to low concentration, right? And that's a passive mechanism. One form of passive transport is called diffusion. Right, and we just described diffusion. Diffusion is that movement of a molecule through a gas or a liquid. Things can't move through a solid because everything's all glued together. But in a liquid or a gas, a molecule will move from high concentration to low. That's an example of diffusion. Osmosis is a special kind of diffusion. Right? It's diffusion. So how do molecules move by osmosis if it is diffusion? From high concentration to low concentration. That's how things have to move. Right? And there's two other criteria. Then that molecule has to move across a membrane of some kind. And a cell membrane qualifies as a membrane. So if something, a molecule, moves from high to low concentration across the membrane, it's got two of the three criteria necessary for it to be osmosis. And the third criteria is that it has to be a water molecule. So only water molecules osmose. Right? And that water molecule doesn't move just by from one area to another. It's got to move across the cell membrane, down a concentration gradient. Then that is osmosis. Some of you might know what a solution is. Does anybody know what a solution is? A solution has fluid, so it has a liquid part. And then it also has dissolved solids in it. So if you have a liquid with water and then you pour sugar in it, then that's a solution. Sugar water is a solution. Right? And so a solution has two parts. It's got the solvent, which would be water, and then it has the solute, which is the sugar particle or salt particle or coffee particle or whatever you put, tea particle that you put in that solvent. Right? So to be absolutely clear what osmosis is, right, is that for us it's the water molecule because that's what our body is dissolved in. Right? That's the solution. Right? Our body is a solution. The solvent is water. There might be other kinds of chemical systems that you'll deal with where you use a different kind of solvent, not necessarily water, but other kinds of things. Osmosis then can be, generally speaking, any solvent molecule, not a solute, not a particle, but any kind of solvent molecule moving down its concentration gradient across a membrane would be osmosis. So in other classes, you might define osmosis a little differently. But for us, water is the key molecule. All right, and when water moves from high concentration, let's say it's high concentration outside the cell, low concentration inside, if that water molecule diffuses across this cell membrane, is that an example of osmosis? When the water moves from high to low across the cell membrane that we see right here, is that an example of osmosis? The answer is yes. All those criteria are met. Furthermore, the other question would be, is it active or passive? Does it require energy or does it just happen automatically? It's passive, automatic, just like that perfume molecule. Okay, we'll move down its concentration from high to low. Well, sometimes there are important molecules that are outside the cell in low concentration, and there's a lot of them inside the cell, but nonetheless, the cell still likes to take them up. So a molecule is going to move from low to high concentration, right? So if it goes from low to high, can that be diffusion? No, because diffusion is always the opposite way. Things can move the opposite way, but it's going to take some energy to do that, right? It just won't happen automatically. That's what we call an active transport process. Active means that some energy is going to be used, some kind of engine or something is going to be used to move that molecule. And what is the energy molecule inside of our cells that's used for just about everything? ATP. So here's that ATP molecule. You should know where this is made. What's the organelle that makes ATP for us? Yeah, mitochondria. That's a special job of mitochondria to make sure that your cells have plenty of ATP. This P right here stands for phosphorus. This T stands for tri. That means that this molecule has three phosphorus groups on it, three of them, and that energy is released from ATP when one of these phosphorus groups is broken off. All right, so if we break one of these phosphate groups off, how many are left? Two. Another name for two is di, right? So adenosine diphosphate has two phosphate groups. Then here's that phosphate group that has come off. It's floating around in solution. And then the third entity that is produced is energy. So think of energy as a real thing, like a molecule. It's kind of hard to describe, but energy is a physical thing. And energy... Oh, does anybody know what energy is? I want to just say a little bit about what energy is. Does anybody have a good definition of energy? I sort of do. Energy gives you the ability... Oh, sorry. Energy. Somebody had an idea back there? No? Okay. Energy, yeah.
The ability to do work.
Oh, I love that. Ability to do work. Right? So, some days you might wake up and you feel really lethargic, you don't have a lot of energy, can you do a lot of work? No. You wake up and you have a lot of energy, can you do a lot of work? Yes. Right? So energy gives you the ability to do work, right? And that's why energy is necessary for active transport. It's work to move that molecule from low concentration to high concentration, and energy is required. All right, so energy is gives you the ability to do work. So what can that work be? It can be molecular transport, like moving molecules from across the cell membrane. And if it's active, what's the concentration outside the membrane? Is it high or low? It's going to be low. Concentration is high, right? It's going against that concentration gradient. Or it could be something that's not molecular. It could be more like a particle. Here are some examples of where particles move across the cell membrane. Phagocytosis is one, pinocytosis and exocytosis. Phagocytosis and pinocytosis is a way of bringing material into the cell. So things that are extracellular are brought in. Phago just means eating. Cytosis means cell process, so it's a process of cell eating. It brings material in. Pinocytosis is just a way of the cell drinking. It's bringing in fluid, but not necessarily a particle. So how does that happen? I want to put this away, and maybe I can see a pretty good example right here. Okay, so here is a cell membrane, and the cell membrane forms this little dimple, and that dimple forms to the inside, so there's a little bubble on the outside of the cell membrane, and then, of course, all of that extracellular fluid can move in and out of this little bubble right here, and so it's just a solution. There are really no particles, but there could be sugar and salt molecules, things like that, enter this little bubble, and then the cell membrane comes together, right, and it pinches away from the cell membrane, and then we're left with a vesicle with the particles that were outside the cell, really now inside the cell. And if that's just the fluid, we call that pinocytosis. And, of course, to move all these membranes around like that, it takes energy. And microtubules to pull and push on that membrane. We talked about microtubules a little bit. Phagocytosis, on the other hand, I don't see a fluid, but I actually see a particle right here. So the cell membrane invaginates, forms this bubble. This particle will move in here, maybe by diffusion from high to low concentration, or just by random motion. And then the cell pinches together, and now you have a vesicle, right, inside the cell containing that particle that was outside the cell at one time. And again, this is an active process requiring ATP. So this is phagocytosis, pinocytosis. The reverse of that, I see this arrow only show goes in one direction, but there's a reverse process, right? So you might even want to put in a double arrow, but the arrow going from a vesicle, material inside of a vesicle inside the cell to the outside, for instance, as vesicle moves over to the cell membrane, fuses with the cell membrane, now these contents are free to leave the vesicle. This is a way for material to go from inside the cell to outside. That would be an example of exocytosis. Is exocytosis active or passive? It's active, requires ATP, right, to move these vesicles around and to change the shape of that membrane. And if it is, if this material is leaving the cell, we call that part a secretion, right? So exocytosis is a kind of secretion. That's how hormones leave the body, neurotransmitters or leave cells, just through that process there. That's an active transport process. And a couple nice pictures of that. Okay. What is happening here? I see a vesicle. And I see something inside the vesicle, and it's getting close to the cell membrane, and now it is joined with the cell membrane, and these particles are leaving. What kind of process is this? That's exocytosis, and is it active or passive? It's active. So as a matter of fact, these particles can go from low concentration to high concentration because it's an active process, which is different than diffusion. And here is a really pretty picture of a cell membrane. What's the simplest way to think of a cell membrane, which I see right here? How many layers do you see? Two. So it's a bilayer. And these compounds, each one of these little things right here is a phospholipid, right? So a phospholipid bilayer is one way to think of a cell membrane. And not everything can move across that cell membrane, right? And that's why there has to be different kinds of transport mechanisms. All right. I don't have anything in the chapter for protein synthesis, but I have some slides. It's important to know something about protein synthesis. And, you know, proteins are a class of biochemicals that are real important in our body. There are maybe four major kinds. There's proteins. Anybody think of another major kind of substance in your body? Protein is one. Carbohydrates, sugars is another. Lipids, fats is another, and one more kind of hard to remember is nucleic acids, like genetic material. So nucleic acids, genetic material, lipids, fats, carbohydrates or sugars, and proteins. Those are the four major kinds of molecules in your body. So let's talk about proteins. And probably everybody knows what a protein is made out of. What's a protein made out of? What's a building block of a protein? It's amino acid. Yeah, that's the building block. So let's see how a protein is made. Well, here is the central dogma in biology. And a dogma is just a statement that tells you what to believe. Okay? And everybody believes it, so everybody thinks it's true, but you should never question dogma, right? Because everybody believes it. But if you're in science, what should you always do? You should question everything, okay? But so I'm going to say forget about science for the moment and let's just think about dogma. And this is what people believed a long time ago, and it's really a good place to start. Well, we have a nucleic acid that we call DNA. DNA makes chromosomes. And you know where chromosomes are located. Where are chromosomes located? Inside the nucleus, right? You got extended chromatin, condensed chromatin. When proteins are being made, chromatin has to be in extended form in order for that to work. All right, so you have DNA. It's converted into another nucleic acid called RNA. It's very similar to DNA, but it's just a little bit different. DNA can never leave the nucleus, but RNA made in the nucleus can leave the cell. Right? So DNA is converted into RNA, and then finally that information in RNA is used to make a protein. So these arrows represent the flow of information. Information flows from DNA to RNA and protein. And what can you tell me about these arrows? Bidirectional or unidirectional? It goes in one direction, right? So this information goes from DNA to RNA to protein, never the reverse. Now, why is that a really good thing? Why is it good so that proteins don't change your DNA? Because that's not allowed by this dogma right here. And that's because if you were to have a chicken dinner tonight, you don't have to worry about waking up with a beak and feathers, right? So that is really a good thing. So these arrows only go in one direction. Information flows in this direction. Proteins never determine what kind of DNA you have, but your DNA determines what kind of proteins you can make, right? So that's the central dogma. Now, when you look at this, how many step process is protein synthesis? How many arrows do you see? I see two arrows. Exactly right. Okay, so it's a two-step process. Let's look at the two steps. The first step, and indeed it has to happen just in this order, the conversion of information from DNA to RNA. Both of these are nucleic acids. So you could think of these things as being the same language, right? The building blocks are the same. They're nucleic acids. All right, so what do you call making another copy of something? Right, since the language is the same, this RNA is like a copy of the DNA. You do this all the time. How about if you apply for a job or a college, another different college, and they want to know what kind of courses you've taken, what kind of grades you have? Who do you call to send them some information that they would like to see? Yeah, you call administration records and ask for a transcript. And what's a transcript? Exact copy of all that work that you've done, right? So you can take that transcript, right? And so this first step is what we call transcription. It's like making a photocopy of the DNA. And if you have a transcript in your hand and you lose it, you forget to mail it, that's not such a big deal, because what can you always do? You can go get another copy, right? You can always go back to the DNA, make another copy of this RNA, and that's fine. But if administration and records loses that original file, which would be DNA in this case, then what happens? Well, then it can't be replaced. And if it's inside the cell, then the cell dies. So that's the reason why we have this first step. It just protects the DNA. It makes a working copy of it. And that process is called transcription. All right, so let me slide down just a little bit. All right, transcription is conversion of DNA into RNA. More importantly, probably, is the information in DNA is converted into information in the form of RNA. And where does this take place? You could probably answer that question if you thought about it long enough. Where does transcription take place? Okay, where do you always find DNA when it's being used? In the nucleus. Transcription always happens inside the nucleus with extended chromatin, right? Never out in the cytoplasm, because if you have extended chromatin in the cytoplasm, then it's going to be damaged, easily damaged, right? You don't want to damage that DNA, because then that cell is going to die. All right. There are three kinds of RNA that is made by transcription. You see messenger RNA, transfer RNA, ribosomal RNA. Let's start with that last one. Ribosomal RNA helps make an organelle that we call a ribosome. Yeah, that's not too hard to remember. And the ribosome, remember what the function of a ribosome was? To make a protein. So ribosomal RNA makes a ribosome. That's the workbench where proteins are made. And those are little organelles inside the cell. There's a kind of endoplasmic reticulum that has it, which is called rough ER, and the job of rough ER is to make a protein, because it has this workbench to make it. All right, what's the building block of a protein once again? Oh yeah, amino acid. So a ribosome needs amino acids to make a protein. So there is another molecule that brings amino acids to the ribosome to be put into a protein, and that is tRNA, transfer RNA. Carries amino acids to the ribosome to make a protein. You could actually think of that as taxi RNA if you wanted to. And you could use that with me. I would know what you're talking about. But don't tell anybody that I taught you that it's taxi RNA. It's really what? Transfer RNA. Wanders around the cytoplasm, grabs an amino acid, and where does it bring it to? A ribosome to make a protein. Okay. Well, a protein, we said, and you told me that it's made of amino acids. And I like that. That's true. And there are about 20 different kinds of amino acids. And in order to make a protein with just the right shape, then those different amino acids have to be added to the protein in a specific order. Right? And so there is information that tells the ribosome what is that specific order of those 20 different amino acids. And you don't have to know the names of amino acids. That information is what we call messenger RNA. It determines the sequence of amino acids that are put into a protein. Okay, so think of this messenger RNA as like being the dictionary. It gives you the proper spelling of a protein. So if you change the spelling of a word, what happens to that word? Just keep all the same letters, but just rearrange the letters. You still have that same word? No, you got a different word, which does what? Has a totally different meaning. Same thing for a protein. If you change the order of amino acids, you change the structure of that protein, you change the function. And if it happens by accident, then usually that's a useless protein. And you're missing whatever protein should be made. And that could be lethal. All right, so the messenger RNA is real important because it determines the sequence of amino acids or the spelling of that particular protein. All right, so remember, DNA and RNA are basically the same kind of molecule. They're nucleic acids. So that is a process we call transcription. And you know that happens in the nucleus with extended chromatin. That RNA, then, these three types, move into the cytoplasm, and there the second process can take place, which is translation. Now, why do we call that translation? I wondered for years and years and years, but probably if I sat down with a dictionary and just looked up that word, I would have known immediately. It's not difficult to appreciate. Translation is converting information in one language and converting it into another language, right? So going from English to Spanish is translation. Farsi to Tagalog, that's translation, right? But what about the information? If you're a translator, what should the information be in English and Spanish? Exactly the same, right? Don't change the information, you just change the language. So the language of a protein is amino acid. The language of RNA is nucleic acid, just like DNA. So going from RNA to protein, we say, is translation. It's changing the basic building blocks. All right, so translation is a way of taking the linear sequence of nucleotides in RNA, and that puts then the proper amino acids together in just the right order. And that's called translation. Now, where does this happen? Where does translation happen? Okay, in the cytosol, right? Transcription inside the nucleus, translation in the cytosol, because if you think about it, that's where you saw ribosomes, out in the cytosol, right? You saw free ribosomes in the cytosol, you saw ribosomes on endoplasmic reticulum. That's where translation takes place, not inside the nucleus. Okay. All right, now why do you make a copy of RNA? Why do you make RNA? Why do you think you make RNA? Maybe a couple of reasons. We talked about why you make RNA through transcription, that process. Because you want to preserve DNA from being damaged? Yeah, that's a good thing. Maybe you need to have a lot of copies. Maybe you need to have thousands of copies. Maybe you're going to apply to thousands of schools and you need thousands of transcripts in order to apply, right? So RNA is a way of making thousands of copies from just one bit of information. That's another good way to think of that, okay? Right. And if RNA gets damaged, is that dangerous to the cell? No, because the information is still in the DNA, right? Okay. Well, I didn't ask you this question before, but I would like to ask you this question. Let me just kind of, don't look at the screen, I'm just going to flash back here pretty fast. All right, so here we see a cell, cell membrane, mitochondria, smooth ER, rough ER, nucleus, Golgi body, centrioles, microtubules. Why do we have all these different organelles inside the cell? Why do we have mitochondria as well as rough endoplasmic reticulum? Why don't we just mix all of these enzymes together? Why don't we just mix all these processes together, get rid of the membranes that separate the mitochondria from the other, like this vesicle right here? They all have different functions, and organelles have different functions. But here is the way that I think about it, okay? the function of the mitochondria would interfere with the function of this vesicle if there is no membrane separating them. The function of this vesicle, like this lysosome, would interfere with the function of this nucleus. Indeed, it would digest it away, right? So these organelles allow all of these different functions to take place with inside one cell without interference. That's the reason why, right? So without interference is the big thing. You could think of this cell right here as being the SEM building, one big building, right? And what would this building be like without any rooms? Let's just say it was one big lecture hall. So I would be lecturing anatomy, and somebody would be lecturing microbiology, another instructor would be lecturing in physiology, and somebody else would be lecturing physics, right? And then math, maybe some calculus and algebra. And I think that would be a wonderful idea, because you could sit in this classroom and pass like 10 classes at one time and graduate in one semester. Would that work? No, because what you learn in anatomy would interfere with the lecture for physiology or microbiology, right? So you could think of this room as an organelle, just separating this function away from other functions inside the building that would interfere with each other otherwise if it was not there. So that's why we have all of these organelles, and our cells are really sophisticated, because all of these functions can happen at one time without interference. Okay, any questions so far on what we talked about? We're pretty good. All right, I think the last thing we're going to look at here is cell division. And in lecture, we went over this. All right, we said for cell division, and this is asexual reproduction, you start with a parent cell, and then these split apart into two daughter cells. And what's the difference between these two daughter cells? Nothing. They're exactly the same. That's why we say it's asexual, right? Asexual reproduction. And that process, where we reproduce cells asexually, is called mitosis. That's the form of cell division. It just produces the same cell over and over and over again. There was something else I wanted to say, but I forgot. But, for instance, if the parent cell has 46 chromosomes, how many does this daughter cell on the bottom have? 46. And what about the daughter cell on the top here? 46, exactly the same. There's no difference between them. All right, so here is an acronym that we made in lab that gives you a hint what the stages or the steps in mitosis are. Right, that's IPMAT, and each one of these letters represents a stage of mitosis. Actually, a better way of saying that is a stage within the life cycle of a cell. Because this first one right here, anybody remember what this I stands for? Interphase. And remember, that's this phase of the life cycle of a cell where it's doing its normal job. If it's an endocrine cell, it's making hormones and secreting it. It's not dividing. So interphase is not really part of mitosis, right? It's what happens outside of mitosis. So really, the first phase of mitosis is P, prophase. Then we got metaphase, anaphase, and then telophase. You should know some of the important points of these things, like prophase. Anybody remember some things about prophase? I'm not even going to show you some slides. Let's use our memory. Prophase is what happens? Something happens to DNA. Somebody said it, but I didn't quite hear. DNA goes from extended to condensed. And condensed you can see in the form of a chromosome. Extended you can't see. So interphase, that DNA is being used. Nucleus looks homogeneous, like this cell right here on the right. I would say this cell is an interphase because I don't see any chromosomes. All that DNA is being used to make a protein. And you know the two steps now that's necessary to make that protein. All right, so the first phase, prophase, extended chromatin condenses into chromosomes. Extended condenses into condensed chromosomes. That sounds silly, but that's what happens. The nuclear envelope disappears. The centriole starts to separate the opposite poles of the cell, and then these microtubules arrange themselves into something we call a spindle apparatus. That all happens during prophase. And in this class, I don't want you to know the difference between early and late prophase. That's not so important. Okay. But in prophase, you do see chromosomes, but they're just going to be all over the cell. They're not going to have any kind of special arrangement. Right? So metaphase, what about metaphase? What can you tell me? Just tell me what it looks like. That's a good way to give me a bullet point. All the chromosomes line up, right? Because they have attached themselves to these microtubules. microtubules push and pull them, so all the chromosomes line up right on the equator of the cell. That's metaphase. Very easy to see. Probably everybody saw that underneath a microscope when you hunted around and looked for it. And then remember, those chromosomes look like an X, because every one of those chromosomes that looks like an X is really two chromosomes put together, two identical chromosomes. Right? And then anaphase, what happens? That X separates, right, into two daughter chromosomes, but they're exactly equal, so that both daughter cells get the exact same information. And then telophase is that the beginning or the end of mitosis? Yeah, telo means end, so that's the end of mitosis. The chromosomes have been completely separated. The nuclear envelope starts to reappear. What else? Oh, the cells start to form a cleavage furrow. They start to bud apart from each other. So that separates cytoplasm into two separate compartments. That happens during telophase. And that separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells, what do we call that? It's a part of mitosis. That's cytokinesis. Yeah. And where does cytokinesis take place? What phase of mitosis? All of them? We're just going to say the last one. Telophase is where cytokinesis takes place. All right, so a good way to think of cytokinesis is separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells. Mitosis is the separation of genetic material into two daughter cells. All right, so that's the best way to think of those two things. All right, so now we are done with cells. Okay, will you guys be able to remember the central dogma? I hope. At least know those two steps. And what's the first violation of this central dogma that we're very interested in today? Well, sometimes information in RNA can be used to make DNA. Okay, and that's a process called reverse transcription. Some viruses have RNA, they don't have DNA. AIDS virus is a really good example. When that infects a person, that RNA is injected into the cell, and then, okay, that RNA is used by a special kind of enzyme to change the chromosomes of that host cell. So that's a special kind of virus. Call that a retrovirus. Right? So you do have to be aware that sometimes we can violate this central dogma, but this is a very good place to start to understand some of the basic processes that are happening. Okay, so for instance, you won't be able to understand reverse transcription if you don't know what transcription is, right? First start with transcription. All right, so that's it for that chapter. Ooh, what's the next chapter? Tissues. The study of tissues is called histology. Review. Okay, I don't know why I have all these red lines right here. Okay, spelling. Control S. Good. Okay. So that is chapter 4. So histology is the study of tissues, tissue structure, and if we understand the structure, we also are aware of the function of that particular tissue, right? So if you have two different tissues, there's two different structure, two different functions with those tissues. So what is a tissue? Tissue is a group of cells, right? A tissue, the basic building block of a tissue is a group of cells. And what can you tell me about all of those cells? They look the same, they have the same shape, right? And so they have the same function. And as a matter of fact, even the junk between the cells is the same if it is a tissue, right? So all of that extracellular material is the same throughout the tissue. All the cells are the same, performing the same kind of function. Okay. All right. Fortunately, there are only four kinds of tissues in your body. And if I point to some place in your body, you would be able to tell me which one of those four tissues it is. It's not too complicated. So let's take a look and see what some of these tissues are. We got four. We've got epithelium, connective tissue, muscle, and nervous tissue. We've got epithelium is a kind of tissue that covers a surface or lines a cavity. I think I want to pull up some slides. Is this it? Ah, good, that's it. I'll put this over here. Okay, connective tissue just connects different parts of your body together. A pretty good example of a connective tissue would be a ligament that connects one bone to another bone to stabilize it. So it's a joint of some kind. Muscle tissue, we got three different kinds of muscles. They're specialized to contract. That's their whole job. Skeletal muscle attached to your skeleton moves your bones around. That's how it got its name. Cardiac muscle is muscle that makes up your heart. And smooth muscle is the third kind. And smooth muscle is found in the walls of hollow organs inside your body, like respiratory tract, blood vessels, reproductive tract, urinary tract, all those things have smooth muscle. And then the fourth kind is nervous tissue. All right, so if I take my finger and point to my skin, what kind of tissue is that? Lines a cavity or covers a surface. Epithelium, right? That's an epithelium. All right, so we're very interested in that. Sometimes people talk about a membrane. And a membrane has two parts to it. It's part epithelium, but it also has connective tissue. Put connective together with an epithelium, then we get something called a membrane. Like the skin sometimes is called the cutaneous membrane. It's a membrane on the outside of our body. Okay. All right, so let's look in particular at epithelium, some characteristics of epithelium. Slide this down a little bit. All right, remember, covers the surface of the body, maybe loin, lines a cavity. So skin is epithelium. The lining of your digestive tract is an epithelium. Lining inside a blood vessel is an epithelium because the inside of a blood vessel is really a cavity. It's got to have a lining. Bones have holes in them, and it has a lining. That's an epithelium as well on the inside of a bone. On the outside of the bone, it has a lining. That's also an epithelium. We'll look at all those things. An epithelium is mostly made out of cells. That's not what I wanted to show you. It's up over here. Okay. So I'm showing you a picture of an epithelium on the right-hand side, and it obeys all of these criteria over here. It has an apical surface and a basal surface, and it never contains blood vessels. All right, so let's look at this epithelium. All right, so I see one cell. I see a nice nucleus. I see some organelles. And this is the superficial part of that epithelium. So there's nothing in this region right here. If this were your skin, this is air. If this is a blood vessel, there would be blood flowing over the cell surface. So this is what we call the apical surface of an epithelium. Right? And it's glued to the rest of your body by a basement membrane. So here's a basement membrane. So this is the basal surface of this epithelium. Here's the apical surface. And is the basal surface the same as the apical surface when you look at this slide? No, they're different. And they can be drastically different. And it's a job of the nucleus to make that difference happen by building different proteins and putting it into different locations right here. So the basal surface generally is a lot different than the apical surface. The cells in an epithelium are tightly packed together. I see maybe just a little bit of a space to them, but when one cell ends, another one begins. There's very little extracellular space. That's another characteristic. And here's a blood vessel. You see this blood vessel going up into the epithelium. I see it down in this connective tissue all the time. Epithelia never contain blood vessels, which is kind of strange. Right. So if you have a lot of cells on top of each other, the ones that are far away from this blood vessel usually are dead because they can't get nutrients. The ones that are close to this blood vessel are nice and alive. What else do I want to say about this? Oh, I see nerves going up into the epithelium. Have you ever gotten a paper cut? You've cut your epithelium and it stings really bad. You put your finger over it because it stings so bad you feel like you're going to bleed to death, right? And then finally you get the courage to take your finger away and look, and guess what? You're not even bleeding. Why is that? Because you've just cut into the epithelium, not deep enough to lacerate this blood vessel underneath it, right? But you still damage these nerves. So epithelium never contains a blood vessel, so it doesn't have blood. All right, so how are we going to talk about the different kind of epithelia that we have in our body? We do it in two different ways. We do it by layers of an epithelium, and also by shape, two different categories. You see shape and layers. Let's talk about layers first. First, you want to identify the basal surface and the apical surface. Here is the basal surface, here's apical. So here's that free space that might have air or it might have blood if it's a blood vessel, right? So it just has something in it. And then the rest of your body is down here underneath, deep to the basement, this basal surface or basement membrane. So how many cells do you see from the basement membrane to this apical surface of the epithelium? I just see one right there. So that's what we call a simple epithelium, if there's just one cell. Let's look at the one down here underneath it. Here's the basement membrane. Here's the apical surface. Your eye should always identify those things quickly as possible. And then how many cell layers do you see between the basal surface and the apical surface? Is it one or is it many? Many. You don't have to count the number. If it's more than one, it's many, and we call that stratified. So generally speaking, you can have two kinds of epithelium, one simple or one stratified, one layer or many layers. So that's how we classify epithelium by layers. The second way is by shape. And here are three shapes, three standard shapes that we can classify most epithelia in. If it's like a pancake, then it's flat, right? And flat, we say squamous, right? So anytime you hear that term squamous, you should think of flat. We have squamous regions on our head. Where is it? Flat regions, right here. More or less flat, the sides of your head, but where your ears are. That's a squamous region. Right. So if a cell looks as tall as it is wide as it is deep, then it looks more like a cube. This cube doesn't have four sides, but basically all three dimensions are basically the same. So that's a cuboidal shape. Sometimes a cell is really tall compared to how wide it is, and then we call that a columnar cell, right? So you got squamous, cuboidal, columnar. Those are the three shapes. But to completely characterize an epithelium, we've got to combine both of these terms together. So you might have a simple squamous, you might have a simple cuboidal, you might have a simple columnar, or you might be looking at a stratified columnar, right? Or a stratified squamous epithelium. And guess what? Their shapes are different, right? What else can you tell me about those epithelia if their shapes are different? They have different layers, different shapes of cells, then their function is going to be different as well. Okay, so we'll look at some of that. All right, so classification is by shape and by layers. There is one kind of layer that is atypical. It's transitional. And sometimes it might be just a few layers, then maybe there's more layers, but then the shape of the cell also changes. It changes from something that's almost cuboidal to squamous, right? But it changes from something that looks like a pillow to something that looks really long and flat. That's what we call a transitional epithelium. And that's a shape-shifting kind of epithelium. It changes shape. And so that lines the inside of an organ that's changing shape all day long, namely the urinary bladder, right? It's changing shape. It's getting big when the kidneys produce urine 24 hours a day, that collects urine. And then when you void, then the bladder gets smaller. So the epithelium stretches and then it goes back to its original shape. Then it stretches and then it goes back down to its original shape. That's a transitional. Another thing that epithelium can make are glands. A gland secretes something, right? And it can be a single cell, and we've got a really cool single cell that we're going to look at, or it could be multicellular. But nonetheless, most glands are made up of epithelial tissue, and then a gland will secrete something onto the surface. What do you remember that secretes something onto the surface of your skin, for instance? A sweat gland. It's made out of epithelium. Okay, or into a cavity would be a good example. Like a salivary gland is secreting something into your oral cavity. Or maybe it secretes it into the blood. And the blood is, you could think of that as a cavity because it has a lining, it has an epithelial lining. And those things that get secreted into the blood, we might think of those as being hormones. Right? So that's an important kind of thing. All right, so let's take a look at some of these different kinds of epithelia to see if you can see what's going on. Here is an example. Let's take this pen right here. We could cut this pen in a number of different ways. We could cut it in a nice transverse section. We call that a cross-section. And if we look down from the top, what does that pen look like? If we look right down from the top, you see it to be what? A nice round circle, if we were to make a cut. If we take the pen and cut it this way, what do you see? You see a couple really long structures. We see cells on one side, cells on the other side of the tube, and then nothing on the inside. So it's going to look different depending on how it is cut. Here is something that looks like a circle. So it's a tube, and it's been cut in cross-section. Here's the basement membrane. Here's the apical surface. So by layers, what kind of epithelium is this by layers? How many cell layers thick is this? You could say simple, and then I know simple just means one layer. So here's a simple epithelium. All right, now what about the shape of this cell? Or what about the shape of this cell right here? Look at these nice square corners. That's a cuboidal. So this is an example of a simple cuboidal epithelium. And here's an illustration of that. Kidney tubules, some kidney tubules are made of cells like this. So there's going to be urine or something we call filtrate inside this tubule. You see the basement membrane right here? Nice and dark. It's thin, but it's nice and dark. You can see it. At least I can see it. Is it too bright for you guys to see? I forgot to turn the lights down. Maybe I'll turn the lights down just a little bit. No, that I want to leave on. All right. So here is the basement membrane where I have my cursor. Here's the apical surface, right? Basement membrane, apical surface. So I only see one cell right there. So that's a simple cuboidal epithelium. All of this tissue down here is outside the basement membrane or deep to the basement membrane. We're just going to call that connective tissue. Connective tissue just glues all of these different tubes together. Here's a tube that's cut more in a longitudinal section as opposed to a cross section, so it looks longer as this one over here. Some might look oval because if you take this pen and not cut it in a cross section and not cut it in a longitudinal section but cut in between, what do you end up with? You end up with an oval instead, right? And that's what we see right here. Okay, basement membrane should be nice and smooth and continuous. You shouldn't see cells over here breaking away, okay, and forming cells in this region over here, breaking through the basement membrane. That would be an example of a tumor formation, right? So somebody would recognize that right away. Because you see this nice, smooth, continuous line here and here and here, right? And here, nice basement membrane. All right, so could you recognize this as a simple cuboidal epithelium? I think so, if you look at it a couple times. What about this one right here? Whoa, look at that magnification. Usually we work at, what, about 450 maximum? Here is over 1,000, so this is highly magnified. Here is that free space with something in it. We can find out what that is, maybe just a little bit. Here's the basement membrane. So how many cells do you see from top to bottom?
One.
From basement membrane to apical surface one. So you would classify this by layers as a simple. And what about by shape? Columnar, because look how tall that cell is compared to how wide it is. It's a lot taller. So here is a columnar, simple columnar epithelium. This space, right, it's a tube, so this is forming a tube. This space on the inside of a tube is called the lumen, L-U-M-E-N. And that lumen can contain different things. So in a blood vessel, what's in the lumen? Blood, right, inside that tube. Right, if this is the stomach, then the lumen would contain gastric juice, right, for instance. Okay. All right, what about the next one right here? I haven't talked about this one, but can you see the basement membrane right through here? Here's the apical surface. Here's that free space. And I see some of these structures. I didn't show you an illustration of these, but these things sweep. The function is motility. These things are cilia. Yeah, these things are cilia. They're on the apical surface. Do you see any cilia on the basal surface? No, but you shouldn't be surprised, right? Because the two different surfaces are radically different. Right. Sometimes when I look at this slide, I see 4 cells from basement membrane to apical surface. Another location, I just see one cell. Right. So it's hard to classify this as simple or stratified. But indeed, it is stratified in some locations, so we call this pseudo-stratified. If you see these cilia right here, it's almost always going to be a pseudo-stratified epithelium. There's connective tissue underneath the basement membrane. But focus your eye right here on this cell. I see the nucleus. All right, and it kind of looks like an upside-down wine glass. Can you see a wine glass right here? Or a goblet or something? And that's how it got its name. This is a goblet cell. It's a unicellular gland, right? It's an epithelium, so that's nice. The job of a goblet cell is to synthesize mucus and then secrete it outside the cell onto the apical surface. It doesn't secrete it to the basal surface, to the apical surface. And then all of these cilia are embedded in mucus. And what's the job of these cilia once again? Motility or sweeping. They're always going to be sweeping. This is an epithelium that we would find lining your windpipe or trachea. Right? And so we're breathing in air all the time. It has bacteria, fungi, viruses, dust particles. Right? And we don't want all those things going into our lungs, right? So those things partially get trapped in that mucus, and then the cilia sweep that mucus away. Where does it sweep it? Down into your lungs or up into your mouth? You swallow it down, okay? Not into your lungs. Unless you're a baseball player, you don't swallow it down, but you spit it out. But nonetheless, you still get it out of your body one way or the other. All right, so this is what we call pseudostratified, ciliated, and the apical cells are columnar, so it's also a columnar. Pseudostratified, ciliated, columnar epithelium. And this is a really fun epithelium to look at in lab, and it comes from the trachea. Let's analyze this slide. Here is the basement membrane, connective tissue down below it. So here's the basal surface. What's the surface here? Apical surface. How many layers do you see? Is it simple or stratified? Stratified, all you need is more than one. And the shape of these cells are?
Flat.
So we call that squamous, right? So this is a stratified squamous epithelium. I see some cuboidal cells, maybe some columnar cells, but mostly cuboidal. We named the shape of the cells by the apical layer, not the basal layer. So these cells are definitely squamous, so we would definitely call this a squamous epithelium, not a cuboidal, like I see these cells down over here. All right, can you see this basement membrane right through here? Is that easy to see? Yeah, probably so. All right, and as a matter of fact, these are some of the cells that we harvested last week, some cheek cells, right? And a stratified epithelium like this, right, is designed to break away, to slough off. Right? That's one way that it deals with abrasion. Your skin is a stratified squamous. When you put on clothes, it rubs your skin off. But that's okay because you have cells underneath it that replace the cells that rub off. That's the job of a stratified squamous epithelium. Let's zoom in to this one. And maybe you could tell me what's happening here. It's a tube. Here, what's the center of a tube called? The lumen. So here's the lumen. It's containing some kind of material. All right, where should I go with this cursor to get to the basement membrane? You see a basement membrane? What should I do? How should I move it?
Down?
Tell me when to stop. You didn't tell me. Right here. Here's the basement membrane. You see there's a difference between these cells here and these right here? Basement membrane is right through here. So this is the basal surface. And what surface is this? Apical surface. How many cells do you see? Two. So is that stratified or simple? It's got to be stratified. And the shape of these cells are? So here's an example of a very nice stratified cuboidal epithelium with some kind of stuff in there. And maybe this is what, a salivary gland? Yeah, salivary gland and duct. All right, so there's saliva in here. All right, so for on the test, I want you to tell me what kind of epithelium it is. At this point in the class, I don't think I care if you know where it is, right? So you don't have to memorize the organs that have these different kinds of epithelia right at the moment. What about this one? Basement membrane right through here, right? And is this simple or stratified? Stratified. Look at these cells in the apical layer. These are columnar. So this would be an example of stratified columnar epithelium, right? Lines the urinary and reproductive tracts. Okay, and in the male, they're sort of the same thing, not so in the female. All right, here is basement membrane. Here's the apical surface. Here are these pillow-like shaped cells. Right, and these are the ones that can get really thick and short. Okay, here's a thick and short one. And as the bladder fills up with urine, then it becomes really thin and long. It gets elongated. And then voiding, it goes back to this shape right here without any kind of difficulty. So this is what we call transitional epithelium. And you know what? I think that's most of the classifications. Oh, here is a really good example of that goblet cell making mucus, secreting onto the apical surface. Right, and mucus is part sugar and part protein. So what kind of processes are necessary to make mucus if it's part protein and part sugar molecule put together? It needs first transcription, then translation to make a protein. Right, and then it has to be modified. What organelle modifies that protein? The Golgi apparatus, right? And then it packages that stuff into vesicles, and then it can be secreted outside the cell. Okay, and since the Golgi apparatus gets material from only one organelle, what kind of organelle does the Golgi apparatus get material from, proteins from? The rough endoplasmic reticulum. It's got to be rough, it's got to be a ribosome, but it's not a free ribosome, it's rough endoplasmic reticulum. And I think I see some rough endoplasmic reticulum going to Golgi, then to these secretory vesicles. So this is an example of a unicellular gland. You find that in an epithelium. Okay. All right, classification of glands. Sort of important in this class, certainly very important in everyday life, because glands have a tendency to become cancerous. Prostate gland, milk glands, right? Breast tissue, glandular tissue of the breast. So these structures and shapes, layers are really important to know about. Okay. Well, there are two different kinds of glands. Let's look at this slide over here. You got exocrine glands and endocrine glands. They both synthesize some kind of product and secrete it outside the cell. And depending on where that secretion goes, it's one of these two different kinds of glands. Here I see examples of exocrine glands because I see a duct. All of these secretory cells secrete into the duct, and then this tube carries that product to where it belongs, right? So if this is a salivary gland, this tube carries it to your oral cavity, right? So these are all examples of exocrine glands. Exocrine glands have ducts. But sometimes a gland doesn't need a duct for its product to go everywhere in the body. Right? It uses the vascular system. It uses a blood vessel. So there's a gland that secretes a compound into the extracellular space. It diffuses through a capillary into the blood, and then the blood carries it where? Everywhere in your body. Right? That compound that goes everywhere in your body via the blood is called a hormone, and the kind of gland that secretes a hormone is an endocrine gland. So an endocrine gland, another way of thinking of that, is a ductless gland. A ductless gland is endocrine. One that has ducts is exocrine. We'll look at that through the whole semester. All right, so there are different kinds of shapes of glands. Now, what are these right here? Are these exocrine or endocrine glands? These are exocrine because it has a tube. All right, so here's just a simple tubular gland. It's just a straight tube, doesn't have any branching, doesn't have a big bulb on the end. Right, that's a simple tubular. Here's a simple alveolar. Notice that here's this big bulb at the end of the tube. So this round shape is what we call an alveolus. Anytime we see a shape like that, it's an alveolar type shape. We'll probably use alveolus to describe that shape. But it's simple because I only see one. If there are many branches, whether it's alveolar or simple, then we call it simple branched tubular or simple branched alveolar. Right, but always look for this shape right over here. Then it can be a little bit more complicated. Right, off of a branch, there can even be more branches. So that's a compound duct. Right, so it can be a compound tubular, or it could be a compound alveolar. And maybe sometimes it's a combination of tubular and alveolar, like we see right here. We call that a compound tubulo-alveolar. Now, why can't we put tubular and alveolar together like this and have it make sense? What do you see? I see that O between them. Yeah, so always make sure you pronounce that O, right? Tubulo-alveolar type gland. All right, so A lot of times we need a biopsy of a tumor to find out if it's a benign tumor, cancerous tumor, and that's all diagnosed by the shape of, right, these tubes and the shape of the ends of these tubes and whether there's any structure left. Sometimes cancers, all of these structures get swiped out and you just see cells all over the place. That would be a very advanced form of cancer. Right, so that is it for epithelium. What is another kind of tissue that we want to look at? Connective tissue. All right, let's see what I got. 11:55. What time do we stop in here? 05? Okay. Well, I can give you an introduction to connective tissue. All right, connective tissue does not cover a surface or line a cavity, but it connects different parts of your body together. And here we see an epithelium in all these glands, and notice that the cells are touching each other. They're close together, very little extracellular space. All right, so here is an epithelium, no extracellular space. Here is an illustration of a connective tissue. I see a cell right here, and then a space, and then another cell, and then another big space and a cell. So could this be an epithelium? And then another cell separated with a space, and then a big space with another cell. Could this be epithelium? You might think about that. Here's a blood vessel. Could this be epithelium? No, right? So epithelium, cells are close together, never contains blood vessels. This is an example of a connective tissue. There is a big, huge space. Here's an area right here that it's huge. It doesn't even have a cell in it. Right? And so all this extracellular material is so special, and actually it determines what the function of this tissue is. We call it the matrix. So in a connective tissue has a matrix, and the matrix is what gives that tissue its particular characteristics, not so much the cell. All right, so here we see a long filamentous kind of molecule. This is what we call a fiber. And this is what we call a collagen fiber. Collagen is thick. Collagen is extremely strong. You can pull it from end to end, and it won't stretch, and it hardly ever breaks, unless you're in a really bad car accident or something like that. Collagen is super strong. You could think of this as like a microscopic steel cable or Kevlar thread. Very difficult to damage. The cell that makes this fiber is right here. It's secreting this fiber into the matrix. This is a fibroblast. Fibroblast makes fibers, secretes it into the matrix. Here's another fiber. It's thinner, but it's stretchy. You can stretch this one, and when you let go, it goes back to its original length. Right? Yeah, so that's that demonstrates elasticity. So this is what we call an elastic fiber. You notice that it's smaller, and it has more branching to it compared to this collagen. And then there's one last fiber. Is this one right here called the reticular. How strong do you think this reticular is compared to elastic and collagen? Just by its shape. You can tell the function is it's a lot weaker. Some organs have these reticular, so it's a reticular fiber, only have reticular fibers, not elastic, not collagen. And since reticular fibers are very, very weak, those organs are very delicate. They break apart when they're traumatized. Right? And a good example of that would be a spleen. Spleen has reticular fibers in it, and probably a lot of people know that when you're in an accident, it's very easy to damage a spleen as a result of that. All right, so fibroblast secretes stuff into the matrix, namely those three different kinds of fibers. But here is an area right here that has no fibers. What can you tell me about this area right here? Is it intracellular or extracellular? It's extracellular. So here is matrix, right? Here's a part of the matrix that does not have fibers, but it has other molecules that absorb water. We call that ground substance. Right? Ground substance contains materials that can absorb water. So there's water everywhere right here. Kind of acts like a sponge, right? And since there's water here, things can diffuse from one cell to another. How do things diffuse? How do they go? From where to where? From high concentration to low concentration by diffusion, right? And that's how hormones get around inside your body too. High concentration near the gland that's secreted, low concentration in some other part of your body, and it makes its way there by diffusion. All right, so the most important cell that I see right here is that fibroblast. Here is a blood cell. This is a white blood cell that fights infection. That is a neutrophil. And here is another kind of white blood cell. This is what we call a lymphocyte. You can tell the difference between a lymphocyte and a neutrophil because the lymphocyte is smaller and it's almost 100% nucleus. Here's the nucleus, very little cytoplasm. Here's a neutrophil. Look at that funny nucleus. It has many lobes. It's multi-lobed and it still has a lot of cytoplasm. So I do want you to tell me the difference between a lymphocyte and a neutrophil when we start to look at these things underneath a microscope. So if these are white blood cells, what kind of tissue is blood? Aha. It's a connective tissue. It's a strange connective tissue, right? But it connects your lungs with your heart, connects your lungs with muscles, connects your lungs with your brain. So it's really a connective tissue. But it's a strange kind of connective tissue because the matrix doesn't contain fibers. It is just fluid. It doesn't even contain ground substance, right? It's just fluid. Anybody know what that fluid is in blood? What's the fluid part of blood called?
Plasma.
Yeah, plasma is the fluid part. Cellular part could be white blood cells or red blood cells. I don't see any red blood cells, but this thing looks red right here. All right, let's take a look at some connective tissues. This is a really good slide to start with in lab. And I see some thick fibers. Thick fibers are strong. They're called collagen, made out of collagen. And then I see some branched fibers right here that are just a little bit thinner than the collagen. These are elastic. They go in all different directions. The collagen goes in all different directions. And then I see some cells. Here's the nucleus of one of the cells that's secreting fibers into the matrix. That is a fibroblast, right? That's the nucleus of a fibroblast. But if in lab I ask you what's the name of the cell and have an arrow pointing right here, do I have an arrow? Oh, here. Here's a couple lead lines. And if the question is what are these cells, what would you like to say?
Fibroblast.
If I ask for the organelle, what would you say? Nucleus, right? So if I ask for the cell, just don't put nucleus down because I really want to know that they're a fibroblast, right? Okay. All right. So this kind of tissue can withstand tension in all different kinds of directions because the collagen is oriented in all kinds of directions. There's just not a lot of it there. So it's not a super strong tissue, but it's useful for basement membranes, for holding epithelia onto underlying structures. And it's kind of stretchy, which is also a good thing. I don't happen to see a blood vessel in there, but it contains blood vessels. Areolar connective tissue can also contain fat cells. We can have fat in areolar tissue. So sometimes we call it a loose connective tissue because it's not very strong. Okay, so here is another kind of tissue. This is a reticular fiber. This is very high magnification. Kind of looks like a root system coming off of a tree. These fibers are, what, the strongest? Or the weakest? Weakest. This is the weakest fiber. And as a matter of fact, here's an example of the organ that comes from the spleen. Reticular fibers are weak. If the spleen gets lacerated, right, it just hemorrhages. Of course, for hemorrhage, we would like to suture things back together again. But these reticular fibers are so weak, as soon as you place a suture, more reticular fibers rip, more blood vessels rip, which means then you have more hemorrhage. So you can't suture a spleen together. The only thing you can do is tie off a blood vessel going to that part of the spleen that's damaged and remove it. Hopefully some part of the spleen still is viable, still is not bleeding, right? But if the whole spleen is damaged, then the whole spleen has to come out. Otherwise you'll bleed to death. All right, we'll finish up connective tissue next time. But you'll look at these slides in your book really soon and become familiar with them. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. I don't know who has the sign-in sheet. You can hold it up. Right here. Yeah, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. I'll maybe put it here on the front table. Thank you. And I'll see you Monday. So Monday, we do have class. Not like Monday of this week.